Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We hope you had a fun Halloween weekend. And today's show has us thinking about next week's Veterans Day. In the second half, we often remember the soldiers who fought for freedom, but there are also stories of civilians whose quiet courage saved lives. We'll hear then 4-year-old Charles Spira's story. He fled Antwerp with his mother and sister as the Nazis began rounding up Jews. And that was in 1942. But we begin Main Street today actually thinking about World War I. And a PBS and Prairie Public premiere of a remarkable theatrical event filmed at Carnegie Hall, America Heart in World War I, a Carnegie Hall tribute. It will premiere at 7 p.m. on November 11th on the television service of Prairie Public and is history told live, a 60-piece orchestra of St. Luke's, a cast of standout Broadway voices, rare archival film and images, and the guiding narration of historian John Monsky, who is my guest. John, first, congratulations on this effort and welcome to Main Street.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
For our listeners who are not familiar with your living documentary format, describe it for us and what they'll see and hear when the lights go down and the notes begin.
Well, the good news is it's very different, very interactive. The bad news is it's always hard to describe. It's a little new. But the core of it is an orchestra. It's a 70-piece orchestra. It's a story, narrative, beginning to end, and drama in between, and then accented by music the whole time I'm telling the story. 80% of it were I'm underscored by the orchestra with 5 Broadway singers, all of which vocalists, all of which are just amazing. And it all, and then on the back wall of Carnegie Hall, not on a screen, but on the back wall, we broadcast images from the National Archives, some terrific people down there that work with us. And it looks like the orchestra's standing in the forest or sitting on the beach. And then the element that's also near and dear to my heart are physical objects, often flags from a collection of American flags that I have that are riveted to the story, but that can be other objects as well. We brought in a very famous pigeon from the Smithsonian named Cherami. So the pigeon's not still alive. It was lovingly cared for. But so there's a series of images that are pulled together, and I call it emotional history, and people walk away and they feel moved.
John, why was World War I the right story for you to tell now? And then why tell it through the lens of F. Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby?
Well, I always wanted to do one of these productions on World War I. It's overlooked a little bit, I think. But the thing that probably, as I was working on it, the thing that probably moved me the most was going to the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, the story of the Meuse-Argonne, the largest battle in American history, 1.2 million American soldiers, 125,000 casualties, 25,000 dead, is an incredible story about the United States as it emerged as a world power. So all of those things came together to want to do this story.
The task that you had in front of you to weave narration, archival film, period songs, and a full orchestra with Broadway vocalists, how did you architect, John, that mix? The music advances the history rather than just interprets the history. Is that what you were thinking when you were wanting to present this in your mind?
For each of these productions, I spend about a year working on the research and a little bit longer going to the places. But I'm always looking at the music because music is a product of history and reflects history. It also drives history. Think of the protest movement and the Vietnam War. The music drove it as much as reflected it. So that I never want to miss that in the weaving of the story. It also just the impact on the viewer of the stories. It's more connective. So we have to work it very carefully so it fits with the story and is reflective of the story, but also tells you something about what was happening at the time.
You worked with Michael Mayer, worked with him staging choices, pacing, and how the visuals meet the score. Tell us about that relationship.
When I finished the the script, I have about 70% of the music in mind. Obviously, you're going to want to hear some of the great Irving Berlin pieces of the period and George M. Cohan. But the whole thing has to be underscored. And I start first with Ian Weinberger, who was for 10 years the conductor of Hamilton. He's now working on Chess. He's got a great music history, and I talk to him about the emotion I'm trying to find. Then Michael Mayer comes in. He's a great, you know, Tony Award winning director. And we try to make all of this come together in a way that moves the heart. And it's a collaborative process. We have a big team as it gets bigger. It just starts with me, but by the end there's a choreographer and vocal coaches and the whole thing to bring it to the stage at Carnegie Hall. And so it's very exciting for me because I start with pieces of paper and then you add layers. You go to rehearsals with the Broadway singers and Michael gets involved and Ian gets involved and it unfolds and it's an experience. And as the audience is watching it, I am too, because you can't just pop in and practice at Carnegie Hall.
Musical discoveries from the era, any surprising discoveries that made the cut? And was that process very joyful for you?
Well, one of the things that happened, and you have to remember the time, turn of the, early 1900s, a lot of families had a piano in their house. And piano was a big deal. And we discovered, Ian really first focused on this, that when the war started, sheet music just poured into the Library of Congress. That's where you went to copyright your music. And we mined that music and we got songs like, If He Can Fight Like He Can Love, Good Night Germany. And, When I'm Through with the Army, The Arms of the Army, I'll Come Back to the Arms of You. And so some of that is woven in there that you don't hear, but it's the voice. It's the voice of the country. Some quite poignant, some quite humorous. And so that's mixed in with these more famous songs and adds to the vividness of the production.
You worked with, I believe, Radical Media to film the performance for PBS. What did capturing it for television allow you to do that a live audience might miss? And was it hard for you to consider, hey, I've got a live audience, but I also have a television audience ultimately?
That's a really difficult process. Carnegie Hall is a great hall and it's such a privilege to be in there, but it wasn't built with cameras in mind. And we brought it's Radical, who won the Oscar for Summer of Soul and done, they filmed Hamilton and so forth. They managed to squeeze 10 cameras in there from balconies and all different areas. One actually behind me, which was created some kind of cool shots of the audience. So they just did a brilliant job, but it is different. It's spectacular in Carnegie Hall, and it's spectacular when I go, I'll play with, do these shows with different orchestras around the country. But the film allows you to get so close to the faces of the performers, these five Broadway performers, and you see a different show. It allows you to get closer to the flags and the objects on the stage. It allows you to get closer to some of the musicians and Ian conducting, and it also allows us to cut in on these pictures from the National Archives that are just, some of them are just stunning. Some you've seen before, some you've never seen before. And we also cut in more vividly. It's just harder when there's 3,000 people in the audience to pictures film. We have some footage. It was remarkable. We were able to slow it down of when the Americans arrive in Paris and they have that famous parade and they say, Lafayette, we are here, Lafayette's grave.
Walk me through the editing process, John. Were you able to participate? Some people think that's just the most difficult part of what do we keep, what do we not keep? How do we make the transitions? When do we bring in the archival work that you were talking about? And it's hard for them. Is it a good, fun process for you?
Craig, I don't know how you feel when you look, you know, you see the family pictures of yourself. The first thing I look at, can we get rid of him? I want to look at myself.
No comment. Yeah.
But I'm very involved from the beginning because we have to, this is the beauty of it. And the sublime part of it is we have to cut to, and when you're in the audience, you can flick your eyes to wherever, whatever you want to look at on stage. Here, we're trying to bring you to the image that's most impactful. So it's a struggle to weave it, and because you're directing the viewer, but the color work, the sound work was just fabulous the way Radical pulled it together. And sometimes you have trouble in a hall. Carnegie Hall is fabulous, but you know, getting the sound mix between the orchestra and the singers and the spoken word. Here in the film, we can adjust all that.
I struggle getting sound when I interview one person. I can't imagine what it's like when you do this work. I'm enjoying my conversation immensely with John Monsky. He's written and narrated American Heart in World War I, a Carnegie Hall tribute that premieres on Veterans Day, Tuesday, November 11th at 7 p.m. on PBS and right here on the television service of Prairie Public. It will also be available for streaming at pbs.org and on the PBS app. John, you focus on five figures, talking now about the characters and narrative choices that you made. What tied them together for you, their voices, letters, turning points, and why the five, and describe them for us, if you would?
I started with the Meuse Argonne. Largest battle in American history, 1.2 million American soldiers, 125,000 casualties, 25,000 dead. And who's in the Meuse Argonne but this figure named Charles Whittlesey? Charles Whittlesey led a battalion. He was born in Wisconsin, grew up in Pittsfield, Mass, went to Williams College, probably never expected to be thrust into the middle of a war. And he ends up leading this battalion, the Meuse Argonne, of Americans from everywhere, farm boys from the West, Native Americans, Irish, Italians, everything drawn from New York City. And from Charles Whittlesey, that and his, which is sort of the climax of the story, and his war record is the war record that Gatsby's modeled after. You know, Gatsby was World War I, a hero in the novel that Fitzgerald wrote, Nick the narrator. And that led me to a lot of the other figures in the war. But I started with Charles Whittlesey. Inescapable was Quentin Roosevelt, the fifth son of Theodore Roosevelt, the man who really formed a lot of his thinking in North Dakota. And Quentin is an incredible story, and it's a love story. Fell in love, the great romance with Flora Payne Whitney, who was the daughter of a Whitney and a Vanderbilt. And so the characters kind of started to fit together from that. So World War I was devastating with the losses, but the damage of artillery, the mechanization of the war was far more than people had seen, and particularly in trench warfare, people's faces were ripped apart and no one wanted to look at these soldiers when they came home. Anna Coleman Ladd was an American. She went over to Paris where some of the worst of it was, and she created these masks for these literally faceless boys. And you know, it's one of many examples of American sacrifice, ingenuity, all of it. And she did an amazing job. And we see this all throughout the Americans coming over. Ernest Hemingway shows up as an ambulance driver in the Dolomites. So she's both symbolic, but stands in her own right as a one of the heroes that dealt with the devastation of the war.
You also have a personal connection, your own family story, your great uncle's service, and Silver Star threads through the piece. Was it hard for you to connect that personal story in this production?
So, you know, I'm always careful not, when I do these productions, to make them relatable to everybody. I don't want them to be about me or my family in particular. And when I started out to do this, I knew about my great uncle, but he wasn't going to necessarily show up in the production. And you can call it whatever strikes you, faith, fate, coincidence. But I went to, headed towards the Meuse-Argonne, and I came to a very important hill, which is part of the story of Quentin Roosevelt, who, well, I won't give away the punchline with Quentin Roosevelt, but that hill, I went up that hill, that very sacred hill, and went to the top, and I could see the small town below, and this is where his mother came after the war. And that's why I was there, because of Quentin. And as I came down to the bottom of the hotel, we were looking at the map, and we realized the 42nd Division was right there. That's where my great uncle was, just down the road, basically, and Saul Monsky from Montgomery, Alabama. So we did a little more work, and I realized we weren't far from the Quaw Farm and the York River, and that is where his commanding officer was shot dead, and he took command of an entire machine gun unit and pushed forward with the attack. And for that, he received the Silver Star. And that sort of brought me back to this story of this great uncle. And my father, the uncle came back after the war, and this just told me more and more about the war as I remembered all this. He grew up in my father's home. And my father would tell me how even in the 30s, Uncle Saul would wake up at night sweating, screaming as if he was still on the front lines. And all this sort of woven to a story that I was telling, and there's more about it. I'll still never forget when a couple of years ago, my father was dying and he knew it and he called me over. I thought I was going to receive a word of wisdom or something like that. And he pointed over to a desk and said, "Get that out." And he said, "You keep that, you cherish that." And it was Uncle Saul's Silver Star. And that was the last real conversation I had with my dad. So I thought that story needed to be told.
World War One often to me seems overshadowed by World War II. So what single idea from the show do you think will help people understand how the first war shaped the second?
Well, you know, a number of people have written about this, and at the end of it, I talk a little bit about it. You know, there was kind of too much and little that we still on. There was kind of a too much and too little in that it was probably too harsh, so it created an opportunity for people like dictators to take control. Maybe it needed to be more modulated. And there was no Marshall Plan. So, but at the same time, 100,000 German troops were left in place to give Germany an army to grow on. The interesting thing, and I try not to go too far into that because there's a lot of historical perspective on all of that, but there is an interesting moment in the show. I show rail car 2419. That's the rail car that the Germans surrendered in. And when World War II happens and Hitler takes over France, he forces the French to surrender in rail car 2419D. These two wars are connected. I mean, Truman's there. Patton and MacArthur are both trying to get themselves killed on the battlefield, and Marshall. So they're all there. Eisenhower didn't get shipped over, but he was with the 2 million troops that never made it. 2 million got over, another 2 million were ready to go because we thought it'd be a long war. And by the way, one of the people that he trained was a guy named F. Scott Fitzgerald.
When the curtain falls, what do you hope remains with us? A melody, an image, a question?
Well, I hope people, it's so important, if you are lucky enough and have the opportunity to go to Normandy, that you go to Omaha Beach, but I hope if you go over to Europe, you remember to go 3 hours east of Paris to the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery where 14,000 Americans are buried. It's heartbreaking and moving, and it's symbolic of what we were about. You know, at the end of World War I, the United States did not take 1 ounce of territory. All we ended up with was leases for 9 cemeteries. I think it says a lot about our country and what we are and what we stand for. And trying to do the right thing and being there to do good. And I would tell you, you know, coming back to Fitzgerald and Gatsby and World War One, right in 1926, right after he wrote The Great Gatsby, Fitzgerald wrote something. I'll share it with you. It's in the show. He wrote, "France was a land, England was a people, but America was harder to utter. It was the graves at Shiloh, the country boys dying in the Argonne for a phrase that was empty before their bodies withered. It was a willingness of the heart." And I hope people walk away after that curtain falls inspired by the willingness of the heart that we have then, and I believe we have now.
John, what's next for you?
Well, next I am April 8th, and we're going to film it again. You know, it was a real turning point. I would do these productions, go to New Orleans, Jacksonville, and I do it for an audience. But after one of these productions, very fine organization, Citadel, stepped forward and said, "You need to share this with the rest of the world. We'll help you put this on PBS. And so I've been able to film two of these. And with Citadel's help, we're going to film another one for PBS. And this is about the space program. Why? Mercury, Gemini, Apollo. Why are you doing that, John? And part of it is I was connected to those 400,000 Americans that worked on the space program. And it is another symbol of the willingness of the heart. We didn't have to go do that. John Kennedy said, you know, we're doing it not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And I think it's another story that sort of tells our story. And so that'll be in April. I see it as part of the 250th. It's one of the great moments in American history. And we have fabulous photography, obviously. We were able to dig up some of the high digital images that wouldn't go through the TV cameras, so nobody's seen those, or some of it's now come out. And so that's going to be very exciting. And we're working on the music, of course. And I just this week was working with Ed White's Spacewalk and David Bowie's Space Oddity. And Craig, I know you love music. And I know you'll enjoy seeing Ed White's Spacewalk and hearing David Bowie's Space Oddity.
We'll look forward to that.
So,
John, thank you. Thank you so much. His work, American Heart in World War One, a Carnegie Hall tribute, premieres Veterans Day. That's Tuesday, November 11th at 7 o'clock right here on the television service of Prairie Public and on PBS. You can also stream it online at pbs.org and the PBS app. And if you missed any of my conversation today with John, find it on our Main Street podcast or at Prairie Public. John, best wishes.
Thank you, Craig.
Still ahead on Main Street, a story from a Holocaust survivor in his own words. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and with Veterans Day coming up, we often remember the soldiers who fought for freedom. But there are also stories of civilians whose quiet courage saved lives. In 1942, 4-year-old Charles Spira fled Antwerp with his mother and sister as the Nazis began rounding up Jews. Hidden for 2 years by a Catholic family in the Belgian countryside, their survival became a story of compassion and bravery in the face of terror. Here is A Child Hidden in East Flanders, 1942. A remembrance of courage, endurance, and the humanity that endures, even in wartime.
When early childhood flows easily, without big events or upheavals, it frequently leaves few memories. All that remains is a happy haze. Not so in my case. My name is Charles Spira, and I happened to be a 4-year-old boy when the Germans started rounding up Jews in 1942 in Antwerp, Belgium. What follows is an account seen through a child's eyes of the flight of my mother Fanny, my sister Annette, and myself from Antwerp to the village of Nazareth in East Flanders, Belgium. My mother was a single parent. She was already separated from my father before the start of the war, and he had left for the United States. Maurice and Rachel Daze welcomed us into their home in the Flemish countryside. We remained hidden there for 2 years. The Dazes risked their lives and those of their two children by taking us in. What you'll hear is based on my memories, conversations with my mother and sister over the years, and an account by my sister to Yad Vashem, the memorial to Jewish victims of the Holocaust in Israel. One of my early memories takes place on an Antwerp streetcar in May 1942. My mother is standing near the driver and is carrying me on her arm. The German Kommandantur had ruled that Jews could not ride in the main compartment of streetcars. Two German officers were seated in the main section, and one of them, seeing my mother standing and holding a heavy child, gestured for her to take his seat. My mother shifted me from one arm to the other and pointed to the big yellow star affixed to her coat. The officer turned visibly red. At the next stop, he and his companion quickly descended from the vehicle. The other passengers, who had witnessed the scene, followed them with their gaze. A month later, I was walking with my mother down the street when a big black sedan passed us traveling in the same direction. One could not fail to notice that automobile because traffic was very light due to gasoline shortages. We followed the car with our eyes and froze when it stopped right in front of us. A man jumped out and barked to my mother to show her ID card and ordered us into the rear seat of the vehicle. We sat there, frozen with fear. A few minutes later, the man, who had been standing outside examining my mother's papers, told us to get out and let us go. Much later, my mother found out that we were released because her papers identified her as a Belgian citizen. The Germans had promised to the Belgian king that they would not deport Belgians. That promise was kept for only a few weeks. Some weeks later, it became clear that the roundup of Jews was getting into full swing. I heard much later that one night, a Belgian policeman knocked on the door at my grandfather's house at 56 Grote Beerstraat, where my mother, my sister, and I were living. "There are Jews living in this house, and I have orders to pick them up," he said. My grandfather beckoned to the policeman to follow him upstairs. He showed him my sister, 10 years old, and me, 4 years old, fast asleep in a bedroom. Getting a 1,000-franc note out of his wallet, a large sum at that time, my grandfather asked the policeman, "How can you do this?" while handing him the money. The man did not say a word, walked down the stairs, and left the house. There was a small grocery store in easy walking distance from my grandfather's house, owned by Michel and Martha Duhem. My mother was a loyal customer. She happened to visit the store the day after the policeman's visit. Michel Duhem told my mother, "Madame, you cannot remain in that house. It is far too dangerous. Several of my customers who used to visit the store every day no longer show up. They must have been picked up." I have talked to my sister who lives in Nazareth near Ghent. Her husband is the village baker. They are willing to take you and your children into their house for payment. My mother rightly saw this offer as a godsend and hurried home to discuss it with her parents. My grandfather said, "Go." He was 76 years old and was a founding father of the Antwerp Diamond Bourse, and recipient of the highest decorations of the Belgian state, he thought that the Germans would not touch him. My mother packed a big suitcase, all we could take for the three of us. The next morning, well before dawn, Michel the grocer arrived to accompany us on our journey. The early train from Antwerp to Ghent mostly carried workmen, and we felt very conspicuous with our big suitcase. Nobody liked to be awake that early, and our train compartment was silent. In Ghent, we changed to a local train that would stop in Nazareth some 20 minutes later. Nazareth in East Flanders was a sleepy village of 5,000 souls. The train station was about 3/4 mile from the center of the village. We walked and Michel dragged a heavy suitcase without complaining. The end of the journey was in sight. The bakery of the Daze family was located on Nazareth's village square. The Catholic church was located in the center, surrounded by a cemetery whose wall formed a square. Beyond the wall, a roadway and houses defined the center of the village. When we arrived at the bakery, it was still early morning. The entire family was sitting in the kitchen around a potbelly stove, giving off a red glow. They all stared at us for a while. Then Michel made the introductions to Maurice Daze, the baker, his wife Rachel, and the Daze children, Gabi, a girl aged 12, and Armand, a boy of 7. The fifth person was Mémé, Rachel's mother, who was in her 70s. We were given the biggest bedroom in the house. The bed was huge and was meant to sleep my mother, my sister, and myself. This drastic change in our lives was very unsettling, particularly for our mother, who had been through a lot already. But over the next few weeks, we adapted to our new surroundings. The villagers were told we were relatives of Rachel Daze, fleeing the wartime hardships of the big city. Everybody in the village was Roman Catholic, and it was expected that the newcomers would attend church regularly. My mother accompanied the Dazes to church after some coaching on how to behave during Mass. My sister was 10 years old and was expected to attend school, but being unfamiliar with the trappings of a Catholic upbringing and not knowing any prayers, she would soon raise suspicions. It was decided that she would remain concealed Monday through Friday. The explanation would be that she attended a boarding school during the week and joined her family on weekends. I was too young to attend school, and my days were spent playing with improvised toys and observing the goings-on around the bakery. Maurice kept rabbits and a pig in a shed in the backyard. When it was time to slaughter a rabbit, he would invite me to watch, and one day the big spectacle was the slaughter of the pig. The village butcher came to the bakery for the occasion, and it took several hours one afternoon to kill the animal and butcher the carcass. I still remember that horrifying spectacle today. There were very few toys. Armand taught me how to build small vehicles we called tanks, from an empty sewing thread spool, a rubber band, a thin wax disc sliced from a candle, and a couple of matchsticks. Our tanks battled each other. One day, digging with a little spade in the garden, I found a big glass marble with an intense swirl of ruby-red color in the center. That became a treasure which I hid in a secret place. My sister Annette spent weekdays sitting at the top of the spiral staircase on the second floor, listening to the goings-on in the bakery store without being seen. When a funeral took place in the graveyard, it would be a welcome diversion because she could follow the proceedings from the bedroom window. Our mother helped Rachel in the kitchen and with house cleaning, laundry, and mending clothes. Mémé, the grandmother, turned out to be a problem. We discovered that she harbored a deep-seated hatred of Jews, although, in all likelihood, she had never met a single Jewish person before or arrival in the village. She was enraged that her son-in-law and daughter had taken us in, and she was powerless to do anything about it, because if she turned us in, it would have had dire consequences for her family. One morning, I was hungry, and I went down to the kitchen by myself before my mother and sister were ready. Mémé was there by herself. I sat down at the table and made the big mistake of reaching for a slice of bread. Mémé could not control herself. She picked up the bread knife and almost sliced off the ring finger of my right hand. I know exactly which finger, because the scar is still clearly visible today. Of course, I shrieked loudly, and everybody came running. Mémé froze where she was standing, realizing what she had done in that fit of rage. Not surprisingly, I kept my distance from that lady from that day on. The days wove themselves into weeks, and the weeks into months. Maurice kept the radio hidden in the cellar of the house and secretly listened to news broadcasts from the BBC. That was a risky undertaking, and frustrating too, because the broadcasts were jammed by the Germans. Several minutes before each broadcast by the Belgian government in exile in London, you could hear a repeated drum sound. Da-da-da-dum, like in Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. It sounds like the dot-dot-dot dash of the letter V in Morse code. The V stood for Vrijheid, which means freedom in Dutch, and for Victoire, meaning victory in French. The relentless repetition of that ta-da-da-dum before the news was eventually also adopted by the English news bulletins of the BBC. It was a constant thorn in the side of the Germans, and they reacted viciously towards anyone caught listening. Often, Maurice would emerge from the cellar and say to my mother, "De Duitsers krijgen klop, madame," meaning the Germans are getting a beating. Occasionally, visitors to the bakery would hint to Rachel that they knew what was going on at the baker's house. It was alarming that people increasingly became aware that Jews had found shelter in the village. Suddenly, the Dazes were ordered to give a room to a German soldier. That made things more complicated. My sister could not sit at the top of the stairs anymore during the day. She remained in our bedroom, where on a shelf lay a huge stack of romance magazines that she started to read methodically. The German soldier took a liking to me, and I remember him tossing me in the air and catching me on the way down. The German and Flemish vocabularies resemble each other somewhat, and everybody was scared that I, by then a five-year-old, would say something inappropriate. But I kept mum. I had been told repeatedly that Hitler was trying to kill all of us, and I had no reason to doubt it. Fortunately, the German stayed only a few days in the house. It was well into the second year of our stay in Nazareth that I frequently noticed large formations of airplanes flying overhead during daylight. Their altitude was far too high for their engines to be heard. During that period, when I played with Armand in the fields surrounding the village, we found them covered with large quantities of aluminum strips, about 4 inches long and a quarter inch wide. I remember collecting the shiny strips and keeping them in an empty cigar box. It became another improvised toy. Much later, we heard that these strips were used as chaff to confuse the German radar installations. In September 1944, rumors were flying around that the Allied forces were only a short distance from Nazareth. The word was, "The Tommies are coming." Tommy was an affectionate nickname for British soldiers. That same night, a large column of vehicles thundered through the village square for hours on end. No one was able to sleep. The Germans were retreating. When dawn rose, an eerie silence had to replace the sounds of military vehicles. When once more the rumble of military vehicles could be heard, excitement rose to a fever pitch. The red, yellow and black striped Belgian flag, long forbidden, started to appear at windows in the village square. The Dazes had a piano and they had learned that my mother knew how to play. With the help of neighbors, the heavy instrument was dragged into the street in front of the bakery. When the first vehicle appeared, my mother started playing "It's a Long Way to Tipperary." Unfortunately, the vehicles turned out to be the rear guard of the retreating Germans, and when the soldiers saw the flags and the overjoyed people, they started shooting. Everybody dove for cover as best they could. Fortunately, the retreating soldiers were in too much of a hurry to linger and do much damage. When less than an hour later, the first Allied military vehicles rumbled into the village, they belonged to a Canadian contingent. Nazareth was liberated. The villagers were jubilant, but the war was far from over. It was also a time for retribution. Village girls who had been seeing German soldiers were rounded up. After the village barber had cut off their hair, they were paraded on a cart around the village square, while the onlookers jeered at them. Antwerp had already been liberated and we were able to return to that city. First order of the day was to find out what had happened to our family. My grandfather had died on the transport to Auschwitz and my grandmother had died in the camp. Of my mother's 5 brothers and 1 sister, 2 brothers had perished in a death camp. The war was not yet over. In October, the Germans started firing V1 rockets, referred to in the street as flying bombs, to destroy the harbors of London and Antwerp. Most of these flying bombs landed in civilian areas. We promptly returned to Nazareth to escape that new danger. After the last of the launching sites of the V1 and the even more lethal supersonic V2 rockets had been destroyed in March 1945, we returned to Antwerp to rebuild our lives. The war in Europe did not end until a month later. We moved into an apartment belonging to the same landlord where we had lived before my mother separated from my father. Mr. and Mrs. Janssens were good people who had kept my mother's furniture and a lot of her belongings in storage for free, without ever touching anything. The loss of her parents and 2 brothers weighed heavily on my mother, not to speak of the damage caused by the stress of living in constant danger, first in Antwerp, then in Nazareth. After our return to Antwerp, my mother never returned to the Grote Beerstraat, where my grandfather's house stood at number 56. My sister Annette was reluctant to go back to school because she was 2 years older than the other girls. She wanted to start working and earning a living. It took a lot to convince her to at least finish high school. I was very happy to start school at last. I was 1 year older than the other boys in my class. We made several return trips to Nazareth, accompanied by 1 of my surviving uncles, each time laden with gifts, to thank the Dazes for their courage and generosity. In 2005, my sister had Maurice and Rachel Daze registered as righteous Gentiles by Yad Vashem in Israel. In a solemn ceremony in Brussels, attended by my sister, her husband and a number of Belgian and Israeli dignitaries, their daughter Gabi and their son Armand, accepted a gold medal posthumously granted to their parents. Millions suffered a horrible fate during the Second World War. What my mother, my sister, and I went through seems mild in comparison. Yet we could not keep ourselves from reflecting constantly over the years how different the life of our family could have been.
That was A Child Hidden in East Flanders, 1942, the story of Charles Spira, who survived the Holocaust as a child hiding in Belgium. You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents Masterworks 2, Music from Within, with works by Mozart, Stravinsky, and Bloch, and performance by Maestro Christopher Zimmerman on piano, and Principal Flute Deb Harris. November 8th and 9th at NDSU Festival Concert Hall. Details at fmsymphony.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Hidden Brain. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 3rd. In the fall of 1910, there was a big scandal in Minot. Citizens wanted to know who drank the beer. 722 bottles of beer had been confiscated the previous year during raids on blind pigs and stored under lock and key at the boiler room of City Hall. But when the beer was needed as evidence in a court case, most of it was missing. That triggered an investigation. Arthur Le Sueur, president of the City Commission, testified that he helped take the contraband to the basement. He and the officers who transported it drank a few bottles, but only, he said, so they could testify that they had indeed seized beer. He warned the officers the beer would be needed as evidence and should not be touched. Later, when the state's attorney informed him that court cases were coming up and the evidence would be required, Le Sueur went to the basement only to find all but a few bottles gone. Police Commissioner Peter Vandenover wasn't in office when the beer was confiscated, but when he investigated, he found just 34 bottles remained. One key to the boiler room was with the chief of police, William Bakeman. The other was left in the sergeant's desk. Bakeman admitted he knew the beer was stored in the boiler room. He and Officer Doherty drank about a dozen bottles each. One officer wanted a few bottles for his sick father, and Bakeman told him to help himself. Plumbers also had worked in the boiler room and had access to the stash. Doherty took the stand. He said he and Bakeman drank several bottles of beer together. Fire Chief E.W. Thompson was also implicated. He admitted to drinking beer in the boiler room a half a dozen times and said he even ordered some taken to the fire hall. He claimed he thought it didn't matter, since he only took small quantities. The matter was settled on this date in 1910. The commission investigating the missing beer requested the resignations of Chief of Police Bakeman, Officer Doherty, and Fire Chief Thompson. When those resignations did not come, the men were fired by a vote of 3-2. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans. And by Jade Presents, bringing Finnish comedian Ismo to the Fargo Theater Sunday, November 16th. Named the quote-unquote funniest person in the world in a 2014 contest by The Laugh Factory, Ismo collaborated with Merriam-Webster on an English-language comedy series. Details at jadepresents.com.
And that wraps up this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow, we'll learn about the Great Plains Children's Museum, and we hope you'll be with us again.